Jen Stout is a journalist, writer, and radio producer from Scotland who is frequently also working and traveling in Ukraine. Originally from Shetland, she's lived in Germany and Russia as well. Her reports are often found in the Sunday Post and on BBC Radio. And she's written a fabulous book, Night Train to Odessa, covering the human cost of Russia's war. And that book and her experiences in Ukraine will form the basis for today's discussion. Welcome to Silicon Curtain. Please like and subscribe so you can discover more fantastic content on the channel. And of course, please do add comments as well, as that really does help to influence the YouTube algorithm. Also, before you buy me a coffee, do also check out the validated Ukrainian charities that appear in the description of this video. It's now more important than ever to help Ukraine and Ukrainians to remain resilient against Russian aggression. Jen, welcome to the channel.
Thank you.
Let's talk about your book and experiences, because your book's based on a number of journeys, but of course you've also been in Ukraine during wartime. So could you give us a bit of background on the sort of genesis of the book and the idea behind it and what you wanted to convey?
Well, the book starts in Russia, actually, because I was living in Moscow on a fellowship for journalists and people in business. So I was in Siberia on the 24th of February 2022, and obviously wanted to leave very quickly, wanted to leave Russia, and we had to wait a few days until we could. I went on to Romania to report there from the border, and a few weeks later I was in Ukraine for the first of what turned out to be several, kind of 2 month trips. The idea to write the book, I suppose, came all the way through because I was gathering so much material, and that doesn't make it into the articles, into the radio pieces. And I also keep a, I usually keep quite a detailed diary, and I was taking up photos and videos, and all of this material, you think, God, I really want to tell the full story of this. So that kind of that came into fruition, I guess, after when I came back for the first time. It was around June 22. I was focusing at this time on getting more thorough hostile environment training, which is difficult because it's quite expensive for freelancers, and so that I could do more frontline reporting. And yeah, so kind of splitting my time between Shetland and Kharkiv for the last 2 years, which is a terrible commute, I would say.
I mean, Shetland to Edinburgh is a pretty daunting commute, let alone Kharkiv.
Yeah, it's not ideal. You just end up, giving all your money to one airline company. Yeah,
Yes,
so I'm
and
now in Edinburgh,
Caledonian
which is
McBrain,
easier.
do they don't do a ferry service, do they?
No, it's
Right.
Logan Air.
Okay, right.
Logan Air. Yeah, I mean, I love Shetland, but it's not it's very difficult to do that kind of job from there. Although it was great when I came to write the book because I sat in the house that I was renting up in the north of Shetland and just wrote for about 7 weeks without really seeing anybody or talking to anyone, going slightly insane. But just that chance to kind of completely immerse myself in all that material, in the diaries and in the reporting that I've done. I'm not sure I could have done it in any other way. You hear these people, they say, oh, I wrote my book in sort of 5 minutes in between dinners. I mean, fine if they're not lying, but I mean, I had to completely immerse myself in it and almost cut myself off a little bit in autumn last year, that was.
And that must provide an incredibly stark contrast as well, the tranquility of Scotland and especially Shetland. And if we can transpose ourselves into the minds of refugees, there must be a similar extraordinary kind of dissonance, especially those who've come to Scotland or Ireland or somewhere rural, between their experiences of, say, escaping from Mariupol. And I talked to quite a few who have done that and ended up in a small English village. It must create, an extraordinary kind of dissonance. And it's not necessarily one that leads to kind of calm, because if you're a refugee and left everything behind, you must still have a high level of anxiety about what's happening to friends, relatives, people in the army, even if your home is not yet being destroyed. There's various reasons why you wouldn't be able to get the repose that location should be able to afford you.
Yes, I think that is really difficult, and I can understand a little bit what it might be like for them, because I found I was so wrapped up in Ukraine, and I have a lot of friends there, really good friends, from previous visits as well. And so when I would come back, it was extremely jarring, of course, because your head is half in Ukraine. You're constantly checking the Telegram channels and seeing what's happening in Kharkiv or in places you know. I mean, at the moment, I'm constantly looking at the maps of the Russian advance in Donbass, and looking at Kharkiv and wondering about the guys that I met there, hoping they're okay. It's this constant kind of anxiety that makes it quite difficult to engage with the world around you, I suppose. And a lot of people I know, other reporters who's kind of spent a lot of time in Ukraine and similarly sort of fallen in love with the country, they say they just find it much easier to just be there. And frankly, I probably would as well. And maybe I'll move there at some point. But yeah, I mean, I would come back. I think one of the most difficult thing about coming back to the UK, as opposed to people who are going back to sort of Poland or Romania, where this is still a very live topic, is coming back to a country where people just aren't talking about it. And that is really difficult. It makes you feel like you're going slightly mad because this huge thing is happening in Europe, very close to us, which we're all implicated in, which has huge implications for our futures as well. And it just, when it flies off the radar, it's very difficult to deal with.
And that must also be interesting, having come from Siberia, from in Russia itself, to go from, I won't call it peacetime, because of course Russia has already been interfering in Ukraine actively, militarily since 2014. So there already was a sort of situation ongoing at that point. But to see, Russia and normal life carrying on there as well. And then realize that those same people who are sort of living their lives, contributing their taxes, etc., possibly even voting for Putin, to then see things unfolding in Ukraine, filtration camps, deportations, abduction, torture, murder on an unimaginable scale, this must also create a certain confusing set of inputs and dissonance as well.
Yes, absolutely. I remember those 4 days I spent in Siberia, it was 24th to 28th of February, as some of the worst of my life. It was utterly jarring, and I was permanently furious. I think because I was receiving messages from friends in Kharkiv saying, they're bombing us with warplanes. They're bombing us with warplanes, and the reality of what that really meant, it took a while to really hit me. They were reducing the city centre to rubble, and yet there I was in this. We were on a program trip in Siberia, so I was being sort of carted around in these fancy jeeps to see the scene. And obviously, I'm not really looking out the window. None of us are. We're all just sort of focused on our phones and the news, but surrounded by Russians who were just not really caring about the situation, or some of them even just sort of laughing about it and making downplaying it a lot. Oh, it's just a special targeted military operation, and you're just being hysterical. And I really found it quite difficult to control myself at that point. Luckily, I had Bennett, my buddy. He's another journalist. He's American. He's just a very big, solid guy. And we get out to the car for a cigarette break, and I'd say, Bennett, we're going to box, and he would just let me sort of hit him in the chest for a bit, ineffectually, and that helped a bit. But yeah, I mean. It was like inhabiting a different world, and you'd think, well, what are they reading on their phones? Are they reading the same stuff as we are? Do they not care? Do they really believe this stuff? And I had Russian friends, of course, who were very against the war, and they mostly left in those early days. They left to Germany and so on, Georgia. But with the people I knew who supported the war, I mean, like many other topics, there were lots of topics we hadn't ever really been able to discuss, like Crimea. Or, to be honest, like lots of bits of history, particularly what my teacher referred to once as those so-called LGBTs, of which we have none. But yeah, the war became another topic that you just absolutely couldn't discuss with some people because that level of Russian defensiveness, it's like you don't even need to say anything. You raise one eyebrow, and within 2 minutes they'll be shouting about Kosovo, or you went to Iraq, and it's so boring. It's like arguing with a sort of with a toddler, So yeah, a lot of those relationships I just sort of lost and couldn't really keep in touch after I left. Yeah.
And then, of course, your direct experience of reporting from within Ukraine, you mentioned there the attitude. But that also, in some ways, translates into what you see on the ground. Not just the attitude of individual soldiers who are committing atrocities, and you can't just sort of palm that off and say, okay, well, this is just an individual's choice. Did you get the impression that this is systematic, that Russia is systematically targeting civilians? Yes, they have the cooperation of their troops. Yes, their troops are then therefore following sort of orders, etc. Some doing it, one would assume reluctantly, but many not. Some actually doing it with great energy and glee, one would think as well. But did you get that direct sense that the Russia strategy is to take it out on civilians and punish civilians?
I don't think anyone could look at the evidence and conclude anything else. It's so clear that they've targeted civilians deliberately all the way through in lots of different ways. When it comes to individual soldiers and their motivations, it's one of those things when you wish that you were able to report on that side and to talk to them and understand. But I mean, there are lots, there's intercepted phone calls, there's some research and interviews done with the soldiers. And I mean, you have to understand, like, the level of kind of brainwashing in Russia for many years now is so extreme. It's so extreme. I talked about, friends or acquaintances that I had that when I was living there. And whenever it got onto a difficult topic, they would just start repeating stuff from the television. And I said, "Well, could you please use your own words, you know?" And they didn't, because they were, I don't know, because deep down they knew it was nonsense, or they felt defensive about it. But yeah, these topics, these talking points, like Ukraine is full of Nazis. Russians don't even know what a Nazi is. Honestly, they don't know what fascism is, because it wasn't in their history textbooks. It's just anyone who opposes us. So this kind of victimhood mentality, we won the Second World War for everybody else and we suffered more, and no one ever gave us the credit. And now NATO's coming to get us. This sort of nonsense, it runs so deep in Russian society, sadly. I think you also have to look at how people live in Russia to understand the levels of brutality, the kind of sadistic torture meted out and sexual violence meted out by soldiers on ordinary Ukrainians. Bear in mind that outside of Moscow and the big cities, outside of the center of those, people live in very poor conditions. There's very high levels of sexual abuse and violence, domestic abuse. There's a cheapness of life in that country, and I think you can see that played out horrifyingly in places like Bucha.
And, we won't get sort of too political there, but, I have a theory that actually keeping people uneducated, keeping people stuck in those cycles of trauma and violence is again a strategy of the government. It allows them to manipulate people, it allows them to use them, in this instance, as cannon fodder. And it allows the creation of, as you say, humiliation on a kind of hierarchical grand scale. That can then be manipulated and used by the government to control people. I mean, do you think that's fair? And what would be your anthropological sort of view on that?
But there's something in that. I think, though, we need to remember that also, Russian society, it's complex, and education is very highly valued in Russia. Science is, they have a very good level of scientific education and medicine and so on. So, there's lots of educated people in Russia who don't swallow the propaganda, but they don't say anything. And
Deeply
they've left
depoliticized,
already.
yeah.
Well, but that, and I think actually it comes back to the kind of depthless cynicism, which is a very Soviet thing. And it's the thing I hate the most, because you can't even have an argument with somebody if they don't believe in anything, or if they're just saying, "Well, you have your truth and we have ours." And it comes from fear, doesn't it? It's the fear of what might happen. It's being in a society where your grandparents' generation would always say, like, "Well, don't help anyone, don't put your head above the parapet, just keep your head down, don't say anything, don't draw attention to yourself." And yeah, we pretend to work and they pretend to pay us and all those kind of things from Soviet times. I think that's very much still there. It's a real, real a real cynicism that I just despise. And Peter Pomerantz's book, Nothing is True and Everything is Possible, I think that sums it up so well. Nothing is true, right? Because what does it mean? But everything is possible. And that I don't that for me it doesn't mean in a good way. It means terrible things are possible.
Terrible things possible and seem to happen on a daily basis. At least there's an escalation even of that. And of course, you've had a long exposure and a lot of time to think about the differences between Ukrainians and Russian, Ukraine and Russia. And of course, some people say that superficially there will be resemblances between some Russian cities and Ukrainian cities, especially in the east. They come from the same, Soviet building template. They had the same sort of decades-long sort of Soviet system, and of course there was the huge effort of Russification in eastern Ukraine to stamp out any vestige of Ukrainian language, even to the point of people changing their names. And if you wanted to get on in academia, or entertainment or anything else, then of course, Russian was typically the only way you could do that. But what's your impression of the core differences between Russia and Ukraine, which Russian propaganda seems, seeks to play down?
I think that's a really, it's a very, very interesting and very complicated topic. But the thing about being in Ukraine at the moment in the last 2 years, I found, is that if you're interested in sociology, if you're interested in societies, watching society building, nation building, but like speeded up, it's extraordinary to be in the middle of it. And yeah, so much of that has to do with people figuring out who we really are and uncovering, unpicking decades and centuries of colonialism, of Russification. And yeah, I mean they didn't just get people to change their names and change their language. I mean they murdered huge numbers of Ukrainian speakers, of course, starting with the well, in Soviet times you had the 1920s intelligentsia, largely in Kharkiv, who all mostly ended up in the Soviet camps and shot. And then, of course, the Holodomor to kill the Ukrainian peasantry, and move in ethnic Russians into those areas, when the hearth was still warm. I mean, that's a horrifying, horrifying history. And the fact that it was covered up for so long, or it was rather, it was unspeakable. You couldn't say it. It was not the official narrative. Makes it very difficult now to unpick some of these things. And to build an identity that's coherent, there's a unity between different parts of the country. But of course, it's so essential. I mean, you ask about the similarities. Of course, there's similarities. Yeah, in the kind of building styles, in the housing, and to an extent, in some of the cultural things. When I was younger, I liked Russia for its people's directness, their frankness. I find that in Ukraine, particularly in the east. But the fundamental differences are very evident. And these aren't, I don't believe in these sort of genetic differences of people. I mean, they say, oh, the Russians are sort of genetically predisposed to have a strong leader. It's just nonsense. It's unscientific nonsense. But yeah, I mean, obviously certain cultures produce a tendency or perspective on the world, and the Russian one is does not favor having revolutions. It favors being quiet and doing what you're told. Whereas the Ukrainians will chuck out any old leader they don't like. I mean, to an extraordinary degree. It really is incredible. It's incredible. The last sort of 20 years of that history. And they're very proud of that, And they say, often I hear Ukrainians say about Russians, well, we had Maidan. Why can't they do it? And I do think that's unfair because like you can't dislodge a dictatorship like Putin's. Look what happened to the Belarusians when they tried with Lukashenko. Look what happened to those people. Yeah, I remember sitting in a bench in Mykolaiv in some point in 2022, May maybe, and I was talking to these two people about politics and about the mayor in Odessa, Drukhanov, who I'd just interviewed. Who, rumors swirl about his loyalties and who he what side he's really on. So, and I'd said they wanted to correct me by reminding me that if Dukhanov, I said, well, how can you tell if he's really on your side, or is he just putting it on? And they're like, oh, it doesn't matter, because we'll just get rid of him. If he says something that we all don't agree with, like, he'll be gone. That's how power. And there was those kind of like sort of weedy sighs, like, I have to explain to the foreigner, that this is how Ukraine works.
It's like Arestovich, isn't it? I mean, if you quote Arestovich or say you watch any of his materials, I mean, now it's no one really wants to watch his materials, but back at the start of the war when he was incredibly popular, especially amongst Russophone audiences, some people would roll their eyes like, oh, do I have to explain to you why he's not a good source of information?
Sure.
You talk about an interesting process there because, of course, on the one hand, we talk of people discovering or rediscovering who they are, uncovering it through history. But isn't it much, much more than that? Ukrainian resilience is built on a lot more than simply rediscovering and recreating the past. Isn't it also based on the idea that you can be playful with that? You can innovate on the past, that actually what you're protecting is not just, a sort of slavish copying of the past, but the freedom to recreate it, to generate something new. That's certainly the impression I get from Ukrainians. They don't have this. They don't treat the past as an icon. The past is something there to cherish, but it's also something that can be malleable. And indeed, that organic creation of a new culture. That seems to me, at least, one of the key distinctions between Russia and Ukraine. In Russia, you do have this concept of canonical literature. You do have a sense that that somehow the past and writers, especially when they're dead, and actually even better if you can kill them off, so you can then manipulate their legacies. That somehow the past has this sort of almost religious iconic sort of status, which perhaps the Ukrainians don't have that same way of thinking about it.
I mean, the main element there is that Russia is imperial. So its concept of itself is of an imperial center with lots of satellites, of people that it can, in the Russian conception, all these other peoples, the Kazakhstanis, the Georgians, the Ukrainians, they're all just basically Russians. And also that they're very lucky to have been taken into the great mother Russia so that they can speak the wonderful great Russian language and they can access the pinnacle of civilization in Moscow University. That's the kind of narrative. Like, I was hearing that in Moscow quite frequently. It's really very common. How dare these young Georgians decide not to speak Russian, they're spitting on everything that we gave them. Ukraine obviously doesn't have that conception of itself. It's a sort of self-contained, clearly defined nation. I say clearly defined, like no nation is ever that clearly defined, but there's always going to be some bits, right? But by and large, yeah, on the 1991 borders. So that's a very different scenario. That's a very different conception, isn't it?
Do you think we have trouble understanding that? I mean, this might sound like a sort of fairly simplistic question, but having Irish ancestors and having studied in Scotland, I developed a sort of nuance, as it were, to unconscious English imperialism, let's say, and to say that Russians have this sort of this sense of exceptionalism, this sort of arrogance, this total miscomprehension or uncomprehending view of their imperial subjects. It's not unique. It's very extreme in Russia, but it's not unique to Russia. And even where you have people who don't mean any kind of ill intent, they may be extremely ignorant about their past, their ancestors' imperial behavior and indeed cultural imperialism and the effect that's kind of had. Do you think we really fail in some ways even now to see the imperial intent behind, say, Russian culture and the various sort of manifestations of Russia that we get in the West?
Yeah, I think our understanding of Russia is problematic. I mean, even the way it's taught in universities, the way that Russian culture is taught, it's still with this sort of very aggrandizing, never problematizing anything, never really sort of glossing over some of the more complicated ethnicities and their experiences, to this sort of wildly romantic Pushkin stuff. When I was studying Russian literature, anyway, it felt a lot like that. And now that's slowly changing, sure. I mean, Russians aren't going to know, they're not going to change their conception about that because they're not learning about that history. Well, it's very simple, right? What you put in the history books really matters. It's why I'm glad that in this country, by which I'll refer to the UK, in the UK, that is changing. It's been difficult and contentious, and lots of people have got very terribly upset, but it is changing the way that we teach our kids what this country was built on, the good and the bad. Has become a lot more honest in recent years, and that's very, very refreshing and necessary also to like move on and develop in any way. And in Russia, of course, you don't have any of that. If anything, it's getting worse. So people would they really hold this belief in a lot of the Soviet propaganda, a lot of the Soviet kind of maxims like "Druzhba narodov," friendship of the peoples, "Bratski narod," brotherly people. And you hear this said all the time by Ukrainians in a very sarcastic way, like, "Oh, look at these brotherly peoples! Like, look what a brother they are." But I mean, when you look at the history of these slogans, it was a Stalinist thing brought in at a time when he was trying to maintain control over a lot of places that didn't like him, and so this kind of propaganda, it was very effective and very powerful. And the Second World War just completely, I mean, really, really cemented that idea that we all fought together and we defeated fascism, even when the West was barely helping us, and it was all us, and it was this grand. And of course there's elements of truth in that, but it became this kind of this thing that knitted together all the identities, and now that's just crumbling. That whole narrative is just crumbling apart, except in Russia, where it's become even, it's almost like the central unifying narrative they have is about the Second World War. But of course, the Second World War only starting in 1941, as it would say in the Russian textbooks, because there was never no Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact.
I was about to say they came late to the party. In fact, they didn't. They kicked the party off, didn't they? Which again, a lot of people don't like to be reminded of that in Russia, that actually the Second World War partly owes its origin to the Soviet Union.
Yeah, it's a very, I mean, even the way that we're taught about the Second World War in this country, I'm realizing now as I read more about this history in Eastern Europe especially was quite flawed, to be honest. It's easier for us over here with our sort of quite triumphal narrative, but there's lots of counter narratives to that. There's, I mean, and actually very relevant to today. I was reading that because I think there's lots and lots of similarities. To be honest, between what's happening right now and what was happening in Europe in the 1930s, because I do believe there's a fascism in Russia, and I think it's very dangerous to stand up to it. And a lot of people in the 1930s felt like this and were sending out these warnings. I mean, look at Martha Gellhorn sort of stampeding across the continent, shouting about fascism and thinking that people would listen, and they didn't. Emma Goldman as well. But a lot of people in Britain didn't give a hoot about the plight of the Poles or the Czechoslovakia. They didn't care because it was far away and they didn't want to get involved. Or there were, just a fair amount of people, particularly in the upper classes, who were outright supporters of fascism. And we just forget that, don't we? Because it's not part of the grand narrative that makes us feel good. So yeah, no country is immune from this kind of historical inaccuracy, historical aggrandizing. But in Russia, it's reached a kind of insane peak of revisionism. And you see this when, if the president is writing his own essays, mad, inaccurate essays, which he then uses to justify invading another country, history is very, very live in this war.
And the Second World War didn't just give rise to that narrative of the Great Patriotic War, etc. Russian Empire united against fascism. It also gave rise to the narrative of Ukrainians being Banderites and essentially collaborating with the Nazis. And this is a really complex area of history, which again I think we have deeply problematical attitude to in the West. There are some appalling incidents in history But there seems to be an overemphasis on that side of Ukraine's history. And there seems to be a lack of nuance in looking at it as well. I mean, I'm having this conversation, and it's deeply problematic because you could apply the same to Finland, which is if faced with Stalin on the one hand and Hitler on the other, and you're a small country, or if you are, let's say, not a sort of Ukrainian nationalist in the fascistic sense, but you have a sense of wanting to be something other than, communist or Nazi. It's an extremely difficult thing, and some people did atrocious acts within that context. Others are simply trying to survive or preserve something of their national identity. It's an extremely complex and nuanced area. And for some of the last couple of years, we seem to really have fallen for, yes, but Ukraine really does have a Nazi problem, etc. We've fallen for the Russian narrative. We've fallen for the simplistic interpretation. And we also seem to have a certain allergic sense to anyone who says they are nationalistic. And we immediately interpret that in a political sense. Whereas I think, living in Scotland shows you can have a very creative sense of nationalism. Cultural nationalism can also be pluralistic, and it can be incredibly open to other cultures. But again, I think we have problems ourselves, which mean that we fail to really come to Ukraine with any kind of nuanced interpretation.
Yeah, well, this is a problem of swallowing Russian propaganda, which we need to stop doing. I would say that particularly to friends on the left. It's I mean that stems from a much bigger problem, which is people hating America more than they can like anything else. So American foreign policy is so evil that anyone opposing it must be there for our friend, which is the position of a 5-year-old. But never mind, that's what they seem to believe in. Yeah, I mean there's lots of untruths that I hear repeated all the time. And one of them is, oh, Ukraine's full of Nazis and it's all been covered up. It's not true. I mean, it'd be great if we could talk about how all across Europe, in lots and lots of countries, there's a very fast growing problem, rise of neo-Nazism, particularly in the UK and Germany and within the armed forces, that no one's really confronting head on. Some of it funded by Russia. Like lots of it funded by Russia, actually. And of course, Ukraine's not immune to that. There was a big problem in I hate this phrase, but post-Soviet countries, which has lots of social factors as well. In the context of Ukraine, it's really important to remember, and I learned this from sort of talking to friends in Kharkiv, which in Kharkiv in 2014, there was a sort of attempted insurrection by pro-Russian or actually Russian collaborators to take over the city, as happened in Donetsk, and it wasn't successful, but a lot of people were badly injured. And so Kharkiv's a very interesting place to look at this. Bear in mind, obviously, in 2014, when Russia was invading and stirring up this kind of unrest, the Ukrainian army wasn't really able to push it back because it was so weak, and so it was reliant. People were reliant on these volunteer brigades, militias, many of which, like Azov, had come from football hooligan groups in Kharkiv, which is where the Azov battalion came from. There were pro-Russian football groups and there were pro-Ukrainian football groups, and football hooligans all over the world, they liked having fights and being quite violent. And lo and behold, they then formed militias. And look, that's simplifying that story a huge amount, I just want to add. But it led to the kind of situation where when I visited Kharkiv in 2018, and I was talking to some LGBTQ activists who were trying to put on a Kharkiv Pride march. They hadn't been able to do that because they would be attacked by these guys. And yet they were simultaneously raising money for some of these other brigades because they knew that that's the better option than being invaded by Russia. Do you know what I mean? Like that's a choice that you and I have never had to make. Do you hold your nose and help out the guys that are at least better than being invaded by Russia? Do you know what I mean? What a choice. What a
It's tricky,
choice.
isn't it? And I guess I think there's a couple of nuances, aren't there? One is, we might have an allergic sense towards someone who describes themselves as nationalistic, but I think there's a big difference between a local, sort of maybe ethnic-based nationalism or a cultural-based nationalism, and we might, as you say, hold our noses and find it objectionable if it's on the political right. But if it's concerned with a country and its identity, it's internally looking, it's not an imperial form of nationalism. So there are degrees of toxicity, aren't there? And Russian nationalism may have some of the same superficial characteristics, but it has this overt purpose to dominate other peoples, other cultures, other territories. It is far more of a threat. And then the other aspect is you may be nationalist, but are you prepared to work with other people? Or do you want to destroy their democratic right? And, you know, I've had some interesting conversations with people who are fighting and are members of Pravi Sector. And, you know, they say, well, we're fighting in the same trenches with people who have fundamentally different views on how you live your life, lifestyles, culture, everything. That may be from different religions, ethnicities, he says, but we've got common cause. So I think that's a kind of interesting nuance as well. You know, you might not like their political views, but are they prepared to collaborate with and support? And the situation described in Kharkiv and indeed Maidan, it only worked because people from right across the political spectrum were able to sort of come together and collaborate in some sense and find common ground.
Yeah, exactly. And that process has led to Ukraine very successfully building a sense of civic participatory nationality, nationhood, as opposed to ethnic. Which again, I mean, it's an interesting comparison to talk about Scotland, and the kind of nationality, the kind of nationalism, which erupted in 2014 as a very broad, quite left-wing, very not ethnic, not specifically sort of were you born here, to the extent that you could vote in the referendum if you lived here, but if you'd moved away then you couldn't, which upset a lot of people. But that kind of broad civic nationalism is very, very evident all over the place in Ukraine, and people talk about it and they're proud of it.
Potentially constructive. I mean, talking about that as well, another characteristic that really struck me is the self-organization and the imperative to solve problems. Now, that might come out of a realization that the central government is either inefficient or simply isn't going to solve these problems for you. But that also strikes back to something you said earlier. Russians like to be told what to do. Ukrainians, and this is very, very broad, obviously, because not everyone's going to behave like this. But Ukrainians I've spoken to, met, and seen in action seem to be constantly looking around like, well, this is broken, right? How are we going to fix it? So, what are your observations on this power of self-organization and problem solving in Ukraine?
I don't believe that Ukraine could have held off the Russian advance 2 years ago without the networks of activists, of civic society that had developed, since Maidan, but of course before then as well. It's absolutely extraordinary how many people are involved in that and the strength of those networks and what they get done. They do the impossible, friend of mine in Kharkiv was, when I was there last year, she's very excited. She said, "You have to come to the fire station tomorrow because there's this great thing that we've got." She'd managed to find an incredibly rare and expensive piece of kit for finding people under the rubble. And it had come via Finland, I think, and had cost a huge amount of money, and she crowdfunded for it, as they all constantly do. And she'd handed it over to the being surrounded by all these firemen who were just like kids at Christmas opening this box. But at the same time, that was a year too late because they'd been trying to pull people out of the rubble for a year in Kharkiv already. It was one piece of equipment. Do you know? So it's like on one hand, it's hugely inspiring and incredible what they do, which they do because they have no choice. It's existential. And on the other hand, it's so depressing how small that is. All their efforts, like it's for a few drones. I mean, talk about David and Goliath, you know?
It's perhaps a factor of, and this is not, I guess, a nice or comfortable thing to say. if Russia had been a half competent army that was not riddled with corruption, that was not extremely hierarchical, if it had copied some of the Western techniques which it had access to, and if it had a bit more, dare I say, innovation and less corruption within its system, it may well have triumphed over Ukraine. It may still triumph, but I don't believe it will. Is the fact that Ukraine has this sort of resilience, and as you say, it's unfortunately not necessarily because it's not directed uniformly through government and at scale, it's not going to have the kind of impact it does. But you're fighting an enemy who, yes, they're brutal and they've got equipment and they've got huge population, but they are monumentally inept. And there's a level there of loathing and mistrust amongst Russians, I think, that means they're not necessarily an effective or complex fighting force.
I don't think the Russian army is monumentally inept. I think that's a massive misconception that has gained a lot of ground. Yeah, there's bits of it that, particularly some brigades where you've got a lot of conscripts and so on. There's lack of morale for sure. There's problems with supply, but no, they're not hugely inept. I don't think we should underestimate them. What the Ukrainians have on their side is being nimble, inventive, and having that network. And also the fact, I mean, obviously the biggest thing is the fact that they believe in what they're doing, that they have this existential thing sort of driving them to do this, fighting so that their children won't have to fight, as they say. Yeah, but I would say we're veering into military strategy, which is a thing I don't claim to
Yeah.
be any expert in.
But I think that's important. I mean, that underestimation, the media in the last 2 or 3 years has swung between overestimating and underestimating Russia and has swung wildly between these different extremes. So I think maybe it's important to get some balance on that because strategy needs to be based on reality, not on these misconceptions. For the last couple of minutes of the interview, let's talk more about the book. Release dates. Are you doing a speaking tour when the book is fully released? And what do you hope people take away? What are the key impressions that you got writing it? What crystallized in your mind? And what do you want people to really experience and come away with when they read it?
Well, it's out on Thursday, 2nd of May. I will be doing an event on in London on in the Frontline Club on Tuesday, 30th of April, and then a series of more launches in Edinburgh and speaking events throughout the summer and various festivals. My hope, I think it's an easy book to read. It's accessible. I try to put in explanations about history and some of the context that we've been talking about, but rather than go off on a sort of slightly dry tangent, I wanted to tell this complicated story through anecdotes, through people, through places, and through stories, because I think that's what appeals most to people, and that's actually the best way to help people understand what is quite a thorny and difficult situation. I also want people to fall in love with these places as much as I did. There's bits of northern Donetsk region that I just think are so beautiful, and I know that's not that sort of going counter to the stereotypes that people have about that place, sort of all grey and Soviet and grim. It's not. The landscapes in Ukraine are so varied. They're so varied, and the cities are also different and so beautiful. I want people to understand more about the psychology and about what's driving these people and what makes them so resilient. And I was so lucky because I'm not a staff correspondent, I'm just a freelancer. So it was just me and my rucksack sort of hopping on the night train and getting a lift with someone. And it means I could really dig down into things. I could stay in one place for quite a while. I'm not being sent from here to there in a jeep. And it meant I could really get a deeper sense, I think. And because I can speak Russian and a little bit of Ukrainian, that obviously is really helpful, of the narratives, the identities, the shifting understandings of what's going on. And really what I wanted to do is paint a very vivid picture of this country, which I fell in love with. I think lots of journalists did, lots of people who were involved in Ukraine did. And on a broader scale, so that people can understand, what I really hate the most is when people say, "Oh well, we just don't really know, do we?" That's insidious propaganda. That's what they mean is I can't be bothered to find out, or it's a kind of like, "Oh, the media are all lying to us," kind of stuff. They say, "Oh, we just don't know who to. We just don't know the truth of what's happening there. We just don't really know," which is nonsense because I say, "Well, you can ask me. Like, I report there. I've been there a lot." But yeah, if they read this book, they have to know. They'll know. It'd be
You're
great.
biased. You've clearly gone native. So,
Look, that's an interesting question, though. I don't believe in ultimate utter neutrality. I don't think it's possible, let alone desirable. I try and be objective and straight in my reporting, and I don't cover up anything that isn't favourable to Ukraine. You know, I'm very straight about that kind of reporting. But look, it's a war against fascism. I have a very clear position on that, and I think that's quite reasonable.
exactly. I think most people watching this channel would certainly concur, apart from the trolls, which we're getting more and more of those as it gets more successful. But I
Leave it
strongly,
to them.
strongly recommend people read the book and really immerse themselves in that impressions, as you say, to experience the sort of, the fiber and the texture of Ukraine, not just war reporting, which it doesn't tell you, about the landscape, the people, and those kind of impressions. So we'll put details into the description of the video. I'm so grateful that you've come on the channel and give us a taste of the book and share your experiences as well. I know it will be greatly appreciated. And good luck with the event coming up next week when you launch the book.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to speak to you.